Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I have no relationships to disclose. To begin with a little introduction, most of you probably know that in Mexico, overweight and obesity is now a public health crisis. Mexico now ranks among the country's highest globally in prevalence of overweight and obesity, but at a much lower level of income per capita than other countries with similarly high rates of obesity prevalence. And this increase in obesity in Mexico has been astonishingly rapid. It's just been shocking, the rate of increase in overweight and obesity in the last 20 years. And another thing that we see in Mexico is that overweight and obesity are now becoming concentrated in low-income communities, similar to what we see in the U.S. and other more developed economies. So today I'm going to discuss a few of the findings from an in-depth ethnographic study that I conducted last year in three communities of different socioeconomic status in the Mazatlan-Sinaloa metropolitan area. Mazatlan is a city of about 500,000 on the west coast of Mexico. And this, what I'm going to talk about today is a piece of a larger research project that I conducted for my dissertation. And in a nutshell, I found that these three communities of different socioeconomic status have very distinct eating environments, very distinct kinds of eating patterns, and very distinct obstacles and challenges to healthy eating habits. The objective for this study was an in-depth examination of behaviors and attitudes related to food and eating in middle school students aged 12 to 15, their mothers and other family members, in an upper, a middle, and a low-income community in this urban metropolitan area, in order to gain a more nuanced understanding of facilitators and obstacles to healthy eating habits in families of different socioeconomic status. And I was also interested in whether I would see in upper-income families the beginnings of behavioral change to adopt healthy eating patterns to try to control weight, as is predicted by Barry Popkin's The Theory of Nutrition Transition. He predicts that upper-income families will be the harbingers of behavioral change in societies going through nutrition transition, and I was curious to see if, in fact, we would see evidence of that. So I'll just briefly talk about some of the methods and procedures. I started by selecting and recruiting for participation three middle schools that represent distinctly low, middle, and upper income communities. Sorry. And so once I recruited those schools, then I recruited through the schools 20 families to participate in this ongoing 7-month-long in-depth ethnographic work. And I picked families that represent sort of the range of experience that's typical in those communities. The study this is a formative and in-depth study, so it was intentionally small scale. It was very time intensive. It involved 8 to 13 sessions or meetings with family members of an hour to 2 hours. So it was a big commitment for them to get involved in this study. And in addition to that, I did some extensive research in the broader community that the families were nested in. I employed a variety of ethnographic methods, structured and semi-structured interviews of a variety of types. I also did photo elicitation, in which the teenagers were given digital cameras and an assignment to take photos of what they eat, where they eat, how they eat, what influences their eating habits of their environments. And it was just sort of an open-ended creative project for them to photograph their eating life. I also then did interviews with them about their photos, and they took notes about their photos as they took them. So I have a lot of really rich information about the kids' perspectives on their eating realities. I also did a variety of forms of participant observation, including grocery shopping with the moms, taking walks with the kids in their communities. I also studied and analyzed and mapped the community's food environments and the study participants' interactions with their food environments, but that's another paper. And I'm happy to discuss my methods and analysis in greater depth with anybody who's interested later. We just don't have time to talk about it in depth right now. Briefly, I'll introduce the three communities. So the low-income community I'm calling the Altamirano, the communities, again, are based around these three schools. So the low-income community is based around a school that's one of the poorest performing middle schools in the metropolitan area. The community consists of low-income families. Most of them are economically insecure. There are high rates of marginal or temporary employment and low levels of parental education and high use of the government welfare assistance program Oportunidades. When I introduce each one of these communities, I just have one photo that sort of captures the lifestyle that's pretty typical in that community. In this photo, there's a study participant toasting tortillas in the cooking area of her home, and she's using a two-burner hot plate to cook on, which is pretty typical in the community. Her family of four live in a single but large room with a patio area that includes a toilet and shower and this cooking area. And this cooking area is actually against the outer wall of their home. Her dad works as an assistant to a bricklayer and doesn't always have work, and her mom is a stay-at-home mom. Neither mom nor dad finished primary school, and the family does not own a car. And that's typical. Very few families in this community own a car. The middle-income community is based around a school that is one of the highest-performing public middle schools in the city. And this community consists primarily of middle and upper middle income families and upwardly mobile families. In this student photo, the participating family is eating a meal in the patio area of their home. This father is a high school math teacher, and the mom sells Mary Kay products, and the family owns one car. And the majority of the families in this participating from this community have one car. All but one had a car. This is the upper income community, and this was based around the most prestigious and expensive private middle school in the city. The community consists of high wealth, high education, and high status families. And in this student photo, the participating student is taking a photo of her two brothers eating lunch by the family pool. The father is a water systems engineer and the mom is a lawyer, and the family retains a housekeeper cook 6 days a week. So I'm going to start by just talking about the overall food patterns that I identified in the three communities. This is a way of depicting them. You won't read it. Don't worry about it. We'll talk about it more in depth. But this is just a way to visualize. I identified distinct food patterns in the three communities based by analyzing all of the many rich sources of data that I collected. I identified the primary core foods that are typical in the community, and these are items consumed three or more times per week. The secondary core foods are items consumed one to two times per week. Supplemental foods are items consumed one to three times per month, and occasional foods are items consumed several times per year. I also looked at what were the common convenience foods in the community, the foods that were relied on to be convenience foods, and what were considered to be luxury foods. So this is just a quick picture of the pattern in those three communities. We don't have time to talk about them in depth, but I'll just identify some of the key features of the food patterns in the low-income and the high-income community. So in the low-income community, some of the key features of the food pattern are that the primary core foods include lots of tortillas. Tortillas are often eaten three times per day, and there may be 7 to 10 or more tortillas eaten with each meal. There's also a heavy reliance on eggs, on beans, on processed meats. The high consumption of processed meats was a surprise for me. All of the communities ate an extraordinary amount of processed meats. Ham, salchichas, which are what we call hot dogs, but they call them salchichas because they eat them in lots of different forms, and chorizo, which is a spicy sausage. The core beverages in this community are milk, carbonated soft drinks, and artificially fruit-flavored drinks like Kool-Aid-type drinks or bottled artificially fruit-flavored drinks. The core diet is also supported by other starchy staples such as rice, potatoes, noodles, and bread. There's greater use of low-cost cuts of meat such as machaca, which is a dried, spiced, shredded beef. There is some consumption of cheese, but less than in the other communities because cheese is a relatively high-cost food. And there was some consumption of small quantities of vegetables, but not a lot of consumption and not a lot of variety, and very, very little fruit. In this pattern, there's the least variety, overall diet variety of the three patterns. So here's some student photos that depict the food patterns in these communities. In the first student photo, we see tortillas. A family of four in this community, it's common for a family of four to buy 2 kilos of tortillas a day. So there's really very, very heavy reliance on tortillas. And this second student photo is a photo of refried beans, and this is a very important staple food in the community. The beans are usually eaten with chili and tortillas, and it may be eaten as a complete meal or as a side dish. And then in these two student photos, the first one we see fried salchichas with scrambled eggs. This is very common. This might be eaten for breakfast, for lunch, or for dinner. It's very common. And then the second photo we see a dish that's called sopa. It means soup, but really it has more different kind of meaning. It usually means a noodle dish. It can have a more liquid broth like this, or it can have a more thick broth, kind of like macaroni and cheese. And this broth is very common. It's made with a bouillon cube and a little packet of tomato paste. This is very commonly consumed. And then also, as I said, we have a lot of sweet and salty snacks eaten in this community. In the first photo, we have a young child eating cronchos, which are fried rings of wheat dough that are usually doused in a sauce, either a sweet sauce or a picante sauce. And this second student photo is a garbage bin with packaged salty snacks and soft drinks. So the upper-income community, we're not going to talk about it the middle, we'll just look at the upper and the lower for today. The upper-income community has very distinct features to its food pattern. Overall, a lot more diversity all across the board. The core, the supplemental, and the occasional foods are a lot more diverse. Tortillas continue to be a valued dietary staple, but they're not consumed every day, and when they are consumed, many fewer tortillas are eaten, perhaps one or two or three or up to four in a meal, but rarely more than that. Eggs and processed meats are also mainstays of the diet. Other core foods are quesadillas, ham sandwiches, boxed cereals, and some chicken and some vegetables and fruits. Core beverages for the kids are chocolate milk, for the parents coffee, fruit juices and aguas frescas, and cold tea drinks. We also see more fruits and vegetables and more variety, including non-traditional vegetables such as broccoli and asparagus. We also see more and greater variety of dairy, more fish and shellfish, better cuts of meat, more valued cuts of meat, more prepared meals and use of restaurants, and use of low-fat and other diet products and artificially and sweetened drinks. And then in these photos, we see commonly consumed items in this community. In the first photo, we have quesadillas. And the second photo, we have a ham sandwich with American cheese, lettuce, and crema, which is like sour cream. And then these student photos, the first student photo is a photo that the student took of the vegetable bin in the refrigerator of her home, showing the variety of vegetables that are common in their household. And the second photo is a fruit salad of papaya, mango, and grapes. And the student was showing that, you know, fairly commonly available fruits and fruit salad available in her household. This next two photos are, the first is a roasted beef taco, and this is a very commonly consumed item in this community, purchased for takeout. Lots and lots of use of takeout food in this community, and this is a very common item with the roasted beef and the toppings. And then the second photo is the Nest Tea Light. The artificially sweetened tea drinks are pretty popular in the upper income community. I'm going to skip that. I was also particularly interested in convenience foods in the communities because of time stress, which we'll talk about a little bit. I see there were similarities and differences in the convenience foods in the communities. All the communities relied a lot on eggs and processed meats as convenience foods. And the low-income community, in addition, relied on those foods because they're inexpensive. But additional convenience foods in the upper-income community are sandwiches, quesadillas, boxed cereals, and meals prepared outside the home. Here's a photo depicting some differences in the convenience foods in the two communities. The first photo was taken by a 14-year-old boy in the low-income community. That's animal crackers and milk. Animal crackers can be purchased in bulk in the traditional market for much cheaper than branded cereals can be purchased. The second photo is an international brand boxed cereals with low-fat milk. And the girl that took this photo took 7 or 8 photos of boxed cereals. And she has a whole row of box cereals in her kitchen, in her house. Just very briefly, I'm going to talk about some of what I identified were stresses on that shaped eating patterns in the three communities. The first is, as you can imagine, economic stress. In the low-income community, economic stress drives irregular eating patterns throughout the month. Before payday, the cupboards are bare. There's little or no money to buy food. Diet's probably limited to beans and tortillas and maybe eggs and salchichas. But after payday, there'll be a little bit more meat. There'll be probably some more treats, a little splurging to feel good after days of monotonous and restricted diets. If and when they have money, the low-income families reported that they would consume more meat and more preferred types of meat, more fish, more cheese, more soft drinks. Several of them said that they would drink soft drinks three or more times per day if they could afford it. More fruit, more packaged cereals, which are considered a luxury item in the low-income community, and more food prepared outside the home. Most families said that they buy the basics first, and they buy fruit only if there's money left over. Soft drinks and sweets and salty snacks, however, are prioritized over fruit. Another stress that shapes the eating patterns in these communities are time stresses. I'm running out of time, so I'm so we get that. I would say that I saw more time stress in the middle and the upper income community because the women worked full time and had higher stress jobs. In the low income community, the women tended not to work full time, largely because they couldn't find work because they didn't have the education levels to get that, to find the jobs that they wanted. This theme of not being able to eat at your hours is related to time stress. There was a high value of being able to eat breakfast before work or school, regular eating hours, family meals at home. But particularly the low and the middle income families reported a lot of stress about just not being able to meet this ideal or this norm and facing a lot of grab what you can, catch what you can eating. Another stress was body image stress, which I saw in the upper income community particularly. All the upper income community women reported enormous social pressure to be thin and having struggled with it their entire adult lives. We can talk more about that in questions. That's not a stress that I saw in the other communities. And then health crisis. If there was a family member facing a health crisis, particularly your own health crisis, this triggered dietary change. It sometimes triggered dietary change for the whole family, but often did not. Where do we go from here is that obviously these different communities face different stresses and different facilitators and obstacles to eating habits, and it calls for community-specific prevention strategies. Thank you. Sorry I talked so fast at the end, but yeah. And I can take a couple questions, or we can just have maybe everybody come up. Yeah.
In the upper income family, you mentioned that most of them had health problems.
Yes.
I just wanted to find out what's helpful in the children eating a little bit better in terms of time, stress, the parents not being able to work their health problems.
Okay, so it's a great question, and I would say yes and no. I found some interesting things. So in all of the upper-income families, these are really upper-income families, they all had household assistance and help with meal preparation. And I would say in the sense of having, say, fruits, like the fruit salad cut up and things like that, yes, that's a time stress that having household helped with. But what I also found in the higher-income families was that the moms and the housekeepers prepared individually tailored meals for each kid, so they were really quite, spoiled, where instead of just preparing one well-balanced meal for the whole family to eat, every kid could say, I don't want this, I don't want that, and they would get a meal tailored particularly for them. So the housekeeper just made it more possible for them to only have to eat what they wanted to eat and never have to eat what they didn't want to eat. So I actually don't think that's necessarily a facilitator to developing eating habits and healthy eating habits in the long run. Yeah.
I found it fascinating that you mentioned that the women were feeling this body image pressure to be thin, but then in our, especially with a lot of the immigrant families here, that you, I think, were the one that mentioned this, that the moms don't want their kids to be thin. Where is this disconnect coming from?
It's a socioeconomic class disconnect. I would say most of the immigrants that are here or that were working in the studies with the other presenter would be low-income families. So upper-income families don't come to the U.S. like that. And so there's a very much of a sort of trophy wife expectation for the upper socioeconomic class women that's not new. It's been in that culture for a long time amongst the very top, and enormous stress about that. Does that answer your question?
It does, but it still doesn't make sense to me because I'm in South Florida, and so we have a very similar farming population there. You know, a lot of the high school females are priding themselves in rejecting the thin image for women, and the ones that are not in the farming community, that are more coastal, that are, you know, closer to the middle incomes, are embracing that same image, and they're not in the lower classes, which it's fascinating just as kind of watching it evolve with, you know, I don't know if it's acculturation, I don't know if it's...
I'm going to open this up more. I mean, I would say this upper-income community that I studied is not very representative of Mexican society as a whole. This is really the elite. But the reason why I wanted to study them was to see if we see evidence of Barry Popkin's theory of nutrition transition, and I would say we do. But they're the creme de la creme. These are going to the most elite private school in the city. So it's not comparative to any kind of public school population that you would see. I mean, if others want to, you guys want to come
up? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can all come up. Yes, and for whoever it is, or I don't know if you want to facilitate the rest of it.
Well, the first thought is that I think there can be some similarities, and I will get in trouble for this, and I have to go home, so I have to think about how to say this. And sometimes the relationship between spouses and husbands as it relates to eating, and it mirrors sometimes the relationship they have with kids as it relates to eating. So the conflation, if you will, of feeling like they have to do things that are that are maybe deceptive on purpose, because if you tell them, oh, I'm going to substitute this for this, they will find some excuse to not eat it, or, you know, oh, I've got to go run to the store, we forgot, or blah, 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 and they'll grab something there and then come home and eat it, or eat less or whatever. So I think all of those things sort of are at play. But, yeah, again, it's not clear to me if the men would eat differently if they actually had more say in what those things are. So I think it's just them expressing that particular concern. But I honestly can't say that if we change it and if they have this open communication that they're necessarily going to eat better, because there are a lot of those things that they actually, you know, they eat what they like. So if we can figure out how to sort of balance those a little bit better, we may do it a bit better.
Yes.
And any way limited
to the
population.
True.
I was wondering if you've done a review of what
kind of
mainstream resources are out there for everybody.
Well, for the folks with resource, there tend to be a lot of commercial influences, and they're actually contradicting what we are trying to do, because they do promote, like, they, people can with resources can believe they can purchase something, and their three-month-old infant will sleep the night consistently, or if they have the right product in front of their toddler's face, then the child will sit still, and that could be an iPad or an iPhone, or, you know. So the resources, they actually think that they can address these behaviors through using those resources. Same issues. Oh, well, all of our information came from really Brazelton or Dr. Bernard up in NCAS, so more of the touch points approach, or just relationships, shared observation, that sort of thing. So it's all out there, but because those commercial influences are so strong right now, there are people you can pay $1,200 to sleep train your infant. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So we kind of come up against those folks sometimes. But that's why I think Kaiser's interest is because they realize this is a universal issue.
All right. If there are no more questions, that'll conclude our session.
Thank you.
To thank everyone.